All I can say, Paul, is that I'm definitely going to hell for the things I did after hours in that church, because obviously we were using things the way it never had been intended to be used. At that point, I had created a monster that would not die. It was one of those things where once you started it, you couldn't get off the train.
Hello and welcome to episode 22 of Vintage Rock Pod, the ultimate weekly classic rock podcast that proudly claims that my music is better than yours. I'm Paul Stevenson. Thanks as always for hitting play. Now, it's another double interview episode today, and both guests are called Greg. What's the chance of that, eh? Now, I've got to say that interviewing today's first guest was probably the most fun I've ever had in an interview. I don't think I've ever laughed that much before. Greg Kinn had some big hits in the US in the early 80s and is such a great character, as you'll hear. He's got some great stories like a mix-up with Squirrels with Bruce Springsteen, flying saucer UFO sighting, and what he did after hours in a church that he says probably means he's going to hell. And that's without talking about his big hit songs too. So I'm excited to let you hear that. The other Greg in question is a drummer with one of my favourite bands. Very sadly, a very short-lived band due to the lead singer passing away just before the debut album was due to be released. The band is Mother Lovebone, the late 80s Seattle group. Now, Greg Gilmore was the drummer in this band, which also contained the flamboyant singer Andy Wood, but also two guys that, in the wake of Andy Wood's death, would go on to form a teeny tiny group that have had just the 5 number one US albums and may have sold upwards of 100 million records worldwide. I'm talking about Jeff Ament and Stone Gossard of Pearl Jam. Anyway, I've got Greg on to talk a little bit about that, plus about the fact he was in a band with another huge superstar in the early 80s, Duff McKagan, who went on to help form Guns N' Roses. Their band was called The Living, and previously unreleased music of theirs is set to finally come out, so we chatted a lot about that as well. So another packed show for you, as always. I had a great response to last week's show. Big interview with Steve Fossen from the band Heart. He told some great stories about his time in the band, and the bit that seemed to resonate with most people was his story about the rehearsal for the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame induction. Now, if you've not had a chance to listen to that episode yet, definitely go back and do so. It had another interview on there as well with author Edwin Amelan talking about his new book about Pink Floyd, and that is certainly worth checking out too. A couple of quick hellos as well to Dave Alcock, listening from a country where festivals are in full swing. Lucky him. Jason Barnard from the Strange Brew podcast, definitely check that out. Janice Robles and Judy Hoffman, and Sounds Records in Canterbury too. Thanks very much for the interactions this week. Love hearing from you all. Right, let's get into this first interview then. It's a cracker. Whatever you're doing right now, commuting, driving, out for a walk with a dog, chilling in your house, maybe you're supposed to be working like my friend Tipso is, but whatever it is, settle in for this and enjoy my chat with Greg Kinn. Now, my next guest on Vintage Rock Pod is an absolute legend in my eyes. I've been playing his music for many, many years, and it's a pleasure for me to speak to him. In fact, it's a kin pleasure to speak to him. I welcome to Vintage Rock Pod, Greg Kinn.
Hey, how you doing, Paul? How is everything?
It's as good as it can be. I tell you what, we're still in lockdown here in Scotland, and I've been 4 months now already without a haircut. As you can see, it's pretty mental.
Yeah, so. Yeah, I just got mine cut yesterday, and I had I just got my second shot. So I should be good to go. I think it's you got to wait a week and a half for that to work its way through your system. But I just got my second shot 3 days ago.
Fantastic.
So I'm hoping whenever the music business lets me in, that's when I'll be back in playing again.
Absolutely, absolutely. And we look forward to that. But what I'm going to do right now is take you back to the very, very beginning, if you don't mind, Greg. Now, obviously, you were born and brought up in Baltimore. Now, the story I want to hear first is one of your mum sending off a tape of yours to a local radio station talent contest. Can you tell us that one?
Do you remember those little tape recorders? I think they were made by Wallensack, and the reels were about 3-inch reels. And I had been recording demos in my bathroom, you know, my mom's house.
Acoustics must have been great.
And one day she found one and she sent it into the radio station, which at the time was WCAO in Baltimore, Maryland. Nothing go, you know, for a week or two or three, nothing happens. Then I get a phone call. We've won the talent contest. And it must have been a tough year for talent, I think, in Baltimore. But what happened was I won three things that would ultimately inspire my life. One of them was a nice electric guitar, a Vox teardrop electric guitar, a little bit like Brian Jones's teardrop.
Nice. Yep.
I also got an electric typewriter, believe it or not, and a stack of records. You know, as if I could have looked into a crystal ball and see that I was on the radio as a DJ for I mean, 17 years in the morning, which is pretty substantial in the Bay Area. Mm-hmm. And obviously I used the guitar and some albums. So all of the things that I got really influenced me later in life. I didn't know it then, but later in life it would be.
Incredible stuff. You touched there quickly on the radio career you had. I mean, as a former radio host as well here in the UK, I mean, 18 years, 17 years on The Breakfast Show, that's some going, isn't
it? Oh, yeah. You know, it's brutal. And man. For that 18 years, I was just like kind of out of the loop, if you will. All of my friends, and I had a lot of friends here in the music business in the Bay Area, like Eddie Money and Huey Lewis and guys like that, Journey. They were all going out, having their tours, just having a rave up time. And I was still back here having to get up at, 5 o'clock on Monday morning. And, it was, I won't say it was difficult, because it was really easy. I basically was being myself and talking about rock and roll. But, the songwriting, that suffered a little bit, obviously the touring. So when I finally got released from that job after 17 years, I was forgotten. So I got a lot of attention going around a third time, and it was a lot of fun. I will say, of all the things that I do, playing live, rock and roll live is the most fun. And that really, it becomes your life, it becomes your mistress. It becomes everything.
And you got to play some huge songs, which became big, big hits as well. And the first of which we'll touch on, obviously, is Breakup Song. It was the one that really, I mean, you guys had you'd released, what was it, 6 albums or so by this point, and you're big in the area, but Breakup Song really catapulted you massive, didn't it?
Yeah. There were a lot of albums that were made. God, how many? That was, I think, our 6th or 7th album.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
When we finally hit with the Breakup Song. And the Breakup Song was really, interestingly enough, it was the chorus of one song and the verses from another song. And I had these chunks of songs. And I remember Steve Wright, the bass player, saying, let's take the chorus of this one and plug it in with the verses of this one and see if it's a song. I thought I was going to be in trouble because I didn't have enough lyrics to stretch through a whole song. So I was just singing, which was, kind of a space filler, it was just, it was a marker there. And I went in the studio, I think it was about 2 days later, to record the song. And I hadn't written any lyrics, so I just stayed with the And ironically, that was what everybody remembered about the song. And I think the fact that it translates into any known language probably helped it along. It was a big hit in Japan. Who would figure,
They could sing along. That was one of the reasons, absolutely.
Yeah.
And then we'll touch on the other massive song, which went huge as well, Jeopardy. I mean, in terms of the song itself, it's fantastic, but it was also very, very groundbreaking in terms of the video as well, wasn't it, at the time? Because there was a concept, there was a story behind it. Because at that sort of stage, early 80s, it was all almost fake live sort of music or bands playing on stage. That was it. But you guys came with a story, and that's what really caught hold.
The cool thing was that it was among the first concept videos. So when we went in there to do this, I remember the band meeting and the director going, well, what are you guys into? Nobody was into anything. It was like, and I finally said, well, I kind of like old horror movies. They go, that's it. That's your idea. So I went, we went in and we had a lot of fun recording that video. I mean, we did things that, it was in a church. It was Mission Dolores Catholic Church in downtown San Francisco, right there on Dolores Park. All I can say, Paul, is that I'm definitely going to hell for the things I did after hours in that church, because obviously we were using things the way it never had been intended to be used. A lot of fun. We did it. I think we did it in one four day suite. And it was fun. I remember we were using cheap little tricks. Like there was a thing where I had a rubber snake around me and it popped up through the floor and wrapped around me and pulled me down. So what we did was we wrapped the snake tightly around me and we shot it in reverse. So it looked like the snake was going and then clamping on my head and then down I went, but it was the opposite, but it was such a cool effect. You know, we actually were a lot of people thought, wow, that was an expensive special effect. No, it wasn't. It was a $29 effect, but it did get the job done. And we had a lot of fun making that video. Was probably one of my best memories of that era.
Brilliant. Absolutely brilliant. And you talk about having fun and stuff. Weird Al took that song, didn't he? And he made his own version of it. And you got involved as well in the video right at the very end.
Oh, yeah. That was beautiful because he called me up to come down to LA to be in the video. And I was just kind of like icing dressing. It was, we did it in one afternoon shoot. And the cool thing about it was I got to meet Don Pardo, the great American announcer, you know, let me tell you what you haven't won. And Don Pardo was funny, and hanging out with Weird Al all day was a lot of fun. And, that was one of the good ones because it was a hit for us. And, I think it got all the way to number one. And then it was a hit for him. And he had to go on the road and promote it. I just had to stay home. It was a lot of fun, too.
Absolutely. And another fun story I heard you once tell is one that I'd love to hear again now. It concerns Bruce Springsteen, the Boss, Rendezvous, and squirrels. Can you fill us in? What connects them?
Well... Springsteen was a fan and used to show up at our gigs, you know, and we were playing at the Roxy in LA, and Springsteen just kind of showed up out of the clear blue sky and he said, you know, I got another song that I guys would like to try. It's called Rendezvous, and it's not been recorded yet, and this would have probably been a Born to Run outtake. That was the era.
Yeah.
I remember doing it and thinking to myself, Springsteen's not really known for his diction. Okay. In fact, he's and it was very hard to understand him at sometimes. And so he wrote down the lyrics to Rendezvous on a napkin from the Roxy, which I put it in my pocket. We had to do a second show. And it turned into white pulp. Just white. Anyway, so I called to Springsteen's office and I asked John Landau, could you send me the real lyrics? I have no idea what I'm singing here. He says, no problem. So he sends me another tape of Springsteen doing the song. And I swear the second verse to me, it's because I played it for everybody.
Yes. Yeah.
It sounded like he was singing, "We desire so much more than squirrels." And I think, that's interesting. Well, anyway, so I recorded it just like he did. You know, you've got to do it with the Springsteen touch. Yeah. "We desire so much more." Just kind of let that last note kind of dissipate. And about 2 months later, when the record comes out, Springsteen calls me and he goes, "Man, there ain't no squirrels in that song, dude." So I don't, you know what the real lyric was? "We desire so much more than this girl." Well, you could have knocked me back with a feather. I was just, "We desire," and so to this day, I still do "We desire so much more than squirrels."
And we do. I agree. We certainly do.
We did. We seize the day.
I just want to touch as well on your surname, obviously Kin. It's something that you've used in so many puns, not just from your albums. You had some incredible album titles, Rock and Roll, Continued and Contagious and all these sorts of things. But you have Kinsets as well, don't you? I mean, where did that first come from? When did you first click on that?
You know, my mother, bless her soul. Right. And you know, she'd always come up with ideas at certain junctures along my career. And we were looking for an album, the second album. Mm-hmm. And my mother said, "Why don't you call it Greg Kin again?" Okay, why not? And then the next one was next of kin. And suddenly, at that point, I had created a monster that would not die. And over the years, I mean, we've had Contagious, Consolidation, Continued. Well, there were 18 or 19 albums, and I couldn't even remember three of them right here. But it is, it was one of those things where once you started it, you couldn't get off the train.
Incredible. And it's lasted even till your most recent album, was it 3 or 4 years ago, Rekindled?
Rekindled. Yeah. Now here we go. Here's my quandary.
Okay.
We're working on an album and we're almost, you know, we're maybe one or two songs from the end. And I'm thinking, what do I call the album? Obviously it's got to have another kin, a snappy, you know, one of those, clever, you know, kind of songs. And, we tried them. I thought that I had done every kin pun in creation, but no, it went on, and it's still going on to this day. It's amazing. What did we settle on? Oh God, I've already forgotten the title. But I think, well, my mom's no longer with us, but I think I would have kept that up until she passed. You know, that was just too good of an idea. And you know, you look back, the albums have their own personalities, you know, those early Berserkly albums, yep, for instance, and mm-hmm, albums that we had, ones that we had done after the Great Breakup Song, and we had a little energy and we had an actual hit behind us. And that, you know, everything made sense. It was all putting one foot in front of the other. Really never gave it a lot of thought. We just were having fun and we just kept going.
And there's a lot to be said for that, isn't there? You mentioned the new album, you're working on new music there. What's it, you say you're a couple of songs away. It sounds exciting. You're in the studio again, mixing and putting tracks down. I mean, when can we expect to hear this album?
Yeah, I have no idea about when it's going to come out because that's a higher pay grade than I
yes
normally am with. But I just put it down as, we don't start off thinking album, you know, like, well, let's get to 10 songs and we'll stop and that'll be the album. We just kind of kept going and until it all mm-hmm felt right. And then we just put it together. I will say this though, subject matter, I'd kind of gone back to my early days musically. And the stuff that we're doing in the studio now, it's like I've regressed and I'm like, I'm a 10-year-old again. And we had so much fun making the album. For instance, the album that the song we're working on today in the studio here is called Saucers on Southway. And it was about an episode when I was a young kid, and we lived on Southway, by the way. Mm-hmm. And my house was buzzed by flying saucers. You know, I was with a friend and we were camping out in the backyard and the saucers came right down. I mean, within inches of our faces. Obviously, we were paralyzed with fear. And it was my best friend at the time, Vinny. Vinny and I jumped up, you know, and ran in the house. You know, no words were spoken because the saucers were just coming right down on us, inches from our noses. And it was such a life-changing event. You know, I thought about those saucers for the rest of my life. Even now, when I'm looking at the sky, I think about them. And I think to myself, you know, what was the purpose of that? Were they trying to freak out two 10-year-old kids? What were they doing? I don't know, but it all worked together. And I got to the point where I just accepted, you know, I got, and other people would start exchanging their flying saucer songs. Now I had one. So it was kind of funny.
Incredible. And you talk about a little bit earlier about your love of horror and old horror and stuff like that. And another thing we should mention is that you're a very successful author as well. You've brought up many books. You've actually won awards for some of your horror stories as well, haven't you?
Yeah. As a matter of fact, I got a new one. Should be coming out, I would say, in the next couple of months. It's called The Devil The Devil and Hank Williams. Ah. And I'm not going to tell you anything more than Hank Williams is a character in the novel. And obviously they deal with the devil. So it's really interesting thing. And then I wrote another one about the mafia in the record business and how they had manipulated. When I was a kid growing up in Baltimore, I would meet a lot of these wise guys, and they always wanted to, you know, hey kid, I want to make you a star. And thank God I never went down that road. But, you know, it's really interesting that I went back to ideas that I'd had when I was a kid with, you know, with the flying saucers and the mafia and stuff like that. And they all seem to fit together right now. There's something going on here. It's bigger than me and it's bigger than you too, Paul. It's something going on here. We'll see.
We'll see. Indeed. And just for everyone who wants to follow you and find out what you're doing and keep in touch with your music and everything, what's the best way to keep in touch with Greg Kinn?
Oh, the best way is gregkinn.com for everything. I've got my literary stuff, so you can. I got like 7 novels written now.
Yeah.
I don't know if I keep wanting this. There's a guy named Dustbin Bob, and he's the guy that obviously cleans out the dustbin. And he becomes friends with the Beatles, and he is has access to all the great 45 RPM records that they were bringing back from to Liverpool from New York, well, back and forth. And the guy that I patterned is after was an actual guy that used to work for Berserkly back in the day. And it all felt together. Sometimes the magic works and sometimes it doesn't.
I think we can say that about everything in life, can't we, Greg? But it's been an absolute pleasure chatting with you, Greg. And we really look forward to hearing this new music when it arises.
Well, thanks a whole lot, Paul. And I hope that I get over on your side of the pond and we can hang out a little bit, maybe hoist a cold one or two.
Absolutely. One or two indeed. Greg, it's been an absolute pleasure.
Thank you.
A born entertainer, isn't he? A great storyteller, and what a life he's had. Looking forward to checking out his new music when it arrives, and interestingly, is in the studio working with Robert Berry, who's worked extensively with Keith Emerson, and in fact joined Keith Emerson and Carl Palmer for an ELP spin-off group in the 80s called 3. So I'm really interested to hear how this new Greg Kinn album is going to turn out. But that's for the future. Right now, though, it's time to look back at his back catalogue as I bring you the Vintage Rock Pod Top 5 Greg Kinn Songs. At 5 is a fairly unusual track for this rock and roller in that it's nearly 7 minutes, but its bouncy, rolling rhythm hustles and bustles along in an almost hushed fashion. It's track 3 on his third album, Next of Kin. At number 5 is Remember. For my choice at number 4, it's the opening track of his 1980 album Glass House Rock. It's a harder song, more frenetic paced, fast-picking guitar and incessant snare drum with soaring chorus vocal, and it's all wrapped up in 2.5 minutes. At number 4 is Castaway. My number 3 song is another upbeat rocky number and another album opener, this time from the 1982 Continued record. Big sing-along chorus always helps too. Number 3 is Happy Man. For number 2, it's Greg's biggest charting single, reaching number 2 on the Billboard Hot 100, high on the Australian charts, and was the only one to get traction here in the UK as well. Unusual for its time, it had a concept video to accompany it. At number 2 from the Conspiracy album in 1983 is Jeopardy. Which leaves us with the obvious choice for number 1, but it is brilliant. It's the song that burst him into the mainstream. It's BT with a driving bass, easy to remember lyrics. They just don't write them like that anymore. It's a memorable, catchy chorus that sticks with you for the rest of the day. The number 1 song from Greg Kinn, according to Vintage Rock Pod, is the fantastic Breakup Song. There you go, those are my thoughts, the best 5 Greg Kinn songs. If you're not familiar with Greg's work, as I know he wasn't a huge name here in the UK at least, definitely check him out, and others as well, because there's some great tunes that missed out on the top 5, like Another Girl, Another Planet with a brilliant Joe Satriani blasting on the guitar. There's Testify, Valerie, Can't Stop Hurting Myself, and the subtle tones of every Love song as well. If you're a fan of Greg, I'm sure you'll probably have your own thoughts on that top 5, so do please let me know. What do you agree with or disagree with? Drop me an email, vintagerockpod@gmail.com, or you can message me on the socials, just search for Vintage Rock Pod. I seem to be on a bit of a roll lately. Last week's top 5 heart songs were met mainly with agreement, The odd track people said should have been included. Marsh Halliday saying Mistral Wind should have been on the list. A couple of shouts from George Williams and Tor Bergson saying These Dreams had to be on there. But on the whole, seemed to go down well, which is quite nice. I just want to mention too, to sign up to become a Vintage Rock Pod VRP VIP, you'll find out first who's going to be on future episodes and get the chance to put your very own question to those future guests too. There will also be giveaways and various other information on there too. All you need to do is sign up on the form on the website vintagerockpod.com. It's completely free. Just head to vintagerockpod.com and fill in the form on the bottom of the first page there. Now it's time to hear from our second guest on this week's show, and it's another Greg. As I said earlier, Greg Gilmore is a drummer and he played with some of Seattle's finest musicians, and I got hold of him to talk about this and about a very special new release. Something new has come to light that you've had hidden away, or I don't know if you was it lost, or is it something that you found recently, but it's kind of come to light, hasn't it? This tape that you had of a band that you had back in 1982 with Duff McKagan, who went on to obviously be in Guns N' Roses, but it's material that you had from when you guys were really young.
Yeah, we were all, 18, 19, 20. The John Conte singer had the original 8-track master tapes, and it was 8 or 10 years, it could have been 10 years ago, 8 years ago at least, I think, that a chance meeting of some people's, the idea of making a record out of these old tapes finally came together. And long story short, that didn't work out. And two more after didn't work out. And then Stone and Regan at Loose Groove got interested and involved, and there was quite a bit of frustration for sure in those years prior, but probably worth it in the end. It's getting more attention than I certainly expected or could have imagined. This is the best situation out of everything. Yeah, it's great.
Good stuff. And you talk about you in the band, and obviously we have to talk about Duff, don't we? Because he did go on to be in Guns N' Roses, and they just kind of blew up. But he was really young, and was he the main songwriter in the band at the time?
He was, yeah.
And the compositions that he did, and you guys went into the studio for a day or two, perhaps, and you laid down these songs, which is what we're now seeing, isn't it? 1982, The Living.
Yeah, it's the result of two recording sessions, and just like they are on the record. I'm not sure that the actual sequence that we recorded was as they are laid out on the record, but the first five songs are from the first session. And then we did a subsequent session with an intern of the engineer of the first session. It couldn't have been more than a couple weeks later. And that's where we did the last two songs on the record. And that was it, two sessions and then a mix session each. Those aren't the mixes that we're using today, but
so give us a bit of information about the band then. I mean, how long were the band together? Did you perform many gigs? Was it a long period, a short period?
Probably from January, sometime in January 82 till it looks like our last show was in July, and probably called it quits not long after that show, at least, I don't know, within a couple of weeks or a month. We did play a fair amount. I don't have a lot of specific recollection of those shows. We did, we went to Vancouver, up to Vancouver once or twice. Otherwise, I think we just played in Seattle. I don't think we even went to Portland, which from here, those are two, you know, it's common to go north to Vancouver, BC, or down to Portland, Oregon.
Absolutely. And you mentioned Seattle there. I mean, this, the guys that have looked after the tapes, and they're talking about this recordings as being the pioneers of the punk of that Seattle movement, aren't they?
It seems to be. Yeah, you know, that kind of, it's always hard to say about that. It definitely, in general, that was the time, you know, the very early days of it here. And as it turns out, this record is a pretty great document of, you know, that moment.
And at the moment, you talk about this record itself, it's going to be released on the 16th of April, and it's going to be available on digital download, that sort of thing, but also on some pretty impressive vinyl as well, different colored vinyl.
Yes. Yeah. As I understand, there are three colors of vinyl, white, red and yellow, yellow, gold, that I think.
Definitely worth it for any sort of collector of the punk kind of early Seattle kind of grunge movement. It's definitely worth listening to and getting hold of. And we talk about that. It's being released on a Loose Groove Records, isn't it? And
yeah.
Co-founder Stone Gossard, who everybody knows, is involved in this whole release, isn't he?
Right. Yeah. He and Regan Hagar, they've both been just super great, really supportive.
Fantastic.
Very enthusiastic.
And just to talk quickly about Mother Love Bone then, because obviously you're the drummer in the band, and what's your memories of playing within that group then with the huge characters that were part of that band?
Yeah, there was a lot of personality in that band, for sure. it was fun. It was really fun. It was a life-changing experience, you know? The whole thing from the first moments. It was a whirlwind, you know. A lot happened, and I don't even know. Was it? And I don't think it was. Was it even three years? I don't think so. It was a couple of years, but you know, took out the business, a record deal, toured a little bit, made a couple of records. We all packed up and went and camped out in Sausalito, California, you know, to make Apple, and that was really fun to just be focused and in this place for no other reason than to make a record. It was fun. I love the whole thing.
Yeah. Fantastic stuff. And it's one of those, I mean, people look back at it now and there's always articles on it and video clips and everything talking about how big the band would have been. They would have been world conquerors. They were right at the front of that whole Seattle movement. And then very, very sadly, Andy Wood passed away, didn't he? Just moments before the record was due to be released.
Yeah.
I mean, that must have been crushing.
Yeah. Yes, it was. I don't know how to, you know, the night that Andy went to the hospital, Jeff and I were out with our manager having a dinner with a prospective tour manager. You know, so we were just at the cusp of putting a tour together. A record was about to come out. And then, you know, a couple of days later, none of that was happening. So, yeah, a lot to deal with in a short time.
Absolutely. And just looking back now on the band and the music, do you listen to the music of Mother Love Bone? Do you listen back fondly?
I do. Yeah, I don't listen to it often, but yeah, I'm still proud of that record. It's a great record.
Absolutely.
Well, like I said, just the process of making it was such an experience. It was maybe for me personally, at least, that's the most significant, powerful part of that whole process was just what it does to your mind, to your playing, to be so intensely focused on something like that. So it's really great. It's powerful.
Well, Greg, it's been an absolute pleasure chatting with you. And like I said, the Living release, 1982, featuring yourself and Duff McKagan from Guns N' Roses and the other boys in the band as well. It's going to be out on April the 16th. And like I said, you can get it digitally and you can get it on vinyl in three different versions as well. So, Greg, thank you very much for joining us here on the Vintage Rock Pod.
Thank you. It's fun.
Big thanks to Greg for taking the time to chat there. I've had a sneak listen to that. I've had a press pre-release copy of the Living album 1982, and it is. It's raw, it's visceral, it's raging punk. If you like that scene, then definitely do check it out. Also on the Mother Love Bone chat, if this is the first time you're hearing of the band, or maybe you've heard the name but haven't listened to them, please do so. Their solitary album has long been in my favourite top 10 of all time. Although they were in Seattle's scene, it's not as grungy as you'd expect. Andy Wood, the frontman, was a very flamboyant in his appearance, demeanour on stage, his lyrics and vocally too. Give them a listen. I've always loved tracks like Captain High Top, Chloe Dancer, Crown of Thorns is another favourite, and then the big hitters of like This Is Shangri-La and Stardog Champion and plenty others as well. And considering they only had one album, it is very, very good indeed. Highly recommended. So that's it for another packed episode then. If this is the first time you've listened to Vintage Rock Pod, then please hit the follow or subscribe button to make make sure you don't miss these future episodes. They come out every Monday morning. There's always big name interviews on there. We get a bit of news as well, some nostalgia, and we fill you in with all your classic rock needs. You can take a scroll back and see some of the big name guests we've interviewed so far, including people from various sorts of classic rock groups, like classic groups like Zombies and The Faces, punk bands like The Buzzcocks. We've got prog groups like Yes, Focus and Genesis. We've got rock bands like Heart, Dire Straits, Big Country. We've got the hard rock bands like Scorpions, Rainbow, Nazareth and Alice Cooper, and solo stars as well like Susie Quattro and John Parr. Thrown in, we also have like songwriters who've worked with the Eagles and rubbed shoulders with the Beatles. We've got authors from journalists and people that have written books and all that sort of stuff. There is loads and loads of stuff going on these previous episodes, so please do go check them out. Give us a follow or a like on social media as well. Just search for Vintage Rock Pod on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and on YouTube as well, where I post some of the videos of the interviews that I've done and various other top fives and quizzes and things like that. So worth checking us out on YouTube as well. Don't forget to sign up to become a VRP VIP at VintageRockPod.com. Tell your friends, your family, your neighbours, your colleagues, anyone really, to get listening and join in. Until episode 23, then remember, if you come across anyone who isn't a fan of rock, just tell them, my music is better than yours. Take care.